I'm John Cork of the Ian Fleming Foundation. On this track, you will hear commentary from many members of the production crew, including stuntman George Leach and optical effects technician Cliff Cully, will begin our commentary.
Well, my name is George Leach, and I was assistant stunt arranger to Bob Simmons. And my friend here is...
My name's Cliff Cully, and at that time, when the Bonds were made, I was working in the rank special effects department as a mat artist. Subsequently, I became head of the department, but not till 67. The oil tanks were at a place called Stanwell, and this set was up on the back lot, and I was up there on the top of the backing with my old Mitchell camera, and we did an optical.
This pre-credit sequence proved complex and interesting. Four major sets, location filming at the Esso oil refinery in Stanwell, England, and numerous effect shots make this mini-Bond adventure a spectacular opening. We begin with an audacious joke, James Bond with a seagull on his head.
There's a close-up of Sean there, so maybe he did the whole thing.
I know he hated it. That gun was made by Bert Luxford. The one he fired over the wall.
Oh, there's Peter Brace, the
That's
guy.
Peter Brace, yeah.
He became the guard. And he's fought with Sean Connery. But I think that was probably somebody doubling. I think that was our joint doubling for Connery that delivered that kick.
This was at Stanwell, all these oil tanks.
With Goldfinger, Bond films started a tradition of breathtaking adventures before the film proper begins, usually with an over-the-top stunt or effect. Cliff Cully and George Leach remember the effect shot that made this opening so memorable.
Well, the thing I remember mostly about the night is we were on the top of a backing, quite high up, and when John Steers let this explosion go off, it got exceedingly warm because it went up in a cloud and then came over towards us, and it was getting very hot. And the amusing thing was that we'd said to Ted Moore, who was the cameraman, remember Ted?
Yes, I do.
Are we going to be all right up here? And he said, yeah, you'll be fine, no problem. And when we looked down, we suddenly heard some banging, and Ted was having a big hide built over his camera with rostrum tops. And we're about 50 feet up. And I thought, well, guys, if Ted figures he needs this kind of cover, what are we doing up here on our own? And it did get very, very hot because it was quite a big bang that night. And I always remember that Harry Saltzman had a load of guests in, and they put a lot of chairs out for them to sit in, and the weather went and it absolutely poured with rain. That was the bang. That's an optical that we did. Do you remember John Hilling, who was the wardrobe man?
Yes, yes.
He had to get Sean out of that supposed wetsuit, which really was a nylon suit made to look like a wetsuit, so he could just unzip it, and he got the evening dress suit on underneath.
It was a very popular shot, that, wasn't it, when he took the wetsuit off, and there was a very elegant white dinner jacket underneath.
It was a very shiny nylon. Of course, this shot coming up now is where we did the reflection in her eye of the guy that comes up behind Sean to hit him over the head.
Yes.
When he's just going to kiss the girl, and then you'll see a reflection in her eye of the guy that comes out from behind somewhere in a minute. That was an optical that we did afterwards. I think that was Pete.
Did he get quizzed in the shower?
Sean throws him into the bath and then throws the electric fire in after him.
That was Alf Joyner went into the bath and was electrocuted.
Yeah. Now it's time to meet stuntman Alf Joint.
Oh, look out, he's behind you. They did an optical on the actress's eye. It was quite good. We did a number where I had to throw a punch and Sean ducks his head and I go flying over the top. It was a very small set. You couldn't sort of wind yourself up to give yourself enough momentum to get over. So he had to help a little. And I think it was difficult for them to shoot it. And I did it about eight times. And by the end of it, I'd had enough. I thought, well, that's it, fellas. And I just sort of sit this one out for a bit. Sean had, as I say, had the same problem because he had to be hit by myself. Around six to eight takes, I think it took, with this chair, balsa wood, which is very light balsa wood, but it's also extremely tough, strong. So it's not the weight, it's the rigidity of the material. And he took about five or six whacks on the back. I thought I might have got a whack from him if I'd have gone on doing it, but he seemed to take it very well. Yes, I met Sean Connery for the first time. I knew him way back in the 60s. And I was up in Scotland to meet a friend of mine. Peter Heatley was a Scots diver, competitive diver. And he was the pond master of a swimming pool in Portobello, which is a little place in Scotland on the coast. And there were two lifeguards there. And one was Jimmy Laurie, I recall, and the other was Sean Connery, or Tammy as they called him. And I believe he just won the Mr. Southeast, Mr. Universe, or Body Beautiful competition. And he wanted to get into showbiz. And a friend of mine, Rube Martin, who did an act where his body was all, and his two partners were painted gold, Herculean hand balancing, where he used to balance one of his partners in a balance on one arm and a planche on the other arm and the other one on his head. He was a prodigiously strong guy. Anyway, he spoke to Sean and he said, "Yeah, I hear you want to get into show business." So Sean said, "Well, yes, we'd like to come down to London." So he said, "Oh, well, fine. Great. Well, what do? Do you do the same kind of gear that we do? Do you do any hand-to-hand work or acro?" They both said, "Well, no, we don't do this." And Jimmy Laurie said, "Well, I crack a few gags and do a bit of comparing." And so then Maroub said, "Well, do you dance or sing?" And they both said, "Well, no, we're not very good at that, no." And so he said, "Oh, yeah, well, do you act?" He said, "What do you do?" They said, "Well, not a lot." So he said, "Well, why don't you stay where you are? You're out here in this lovely Scottish sunshine, you know, you're in the fresh air, you've just won the Mr. Southeast Scotland, whatever it was." He said, "Stay here." He said, you're starved down in London." Because Rube always says to me, he said, "If that guy had ever listened to me, I would have stopped him becoming a very rich man," he said, "because he came down." I always remember seeing his photograph in a big London store, Piccadilly Circus there, Cecil G's. He was dressed up in a Russian-type outfit that looked very striking. And he seemed to blossom from there. I remember he did a couple of pictures with Baker and Patrick McGoohan. And he did a Darby, McGill and the Little People, a Disney picture. That was it, yes. And he came on, he went from strength to strength. I think the first show they ever did was, I think Roger Moore and Sean were in a show, South Pacific. It was Chorus Boys, I remember. Because they all used to come into the local baths where everybody, all the competitive divers used to work out. And they used to sit there and have their lunch and watch what was going on.
In Miami, with a skeleton crew, director Guy Hamilton creates another tradition, the elegant location that outdoes even the most optimistic travel brochure. Quite a few local models were hired to fill out the pool chairs in Miami and on the set built at Pinewood Studios. One of the members of Ken Adams' production design staff, Peter Lamont, recalls the Miami shoot.
Ken, Guy, and Ted Moore did the location in Miami, where they're establishing Miami. They established the Fontainebleau. The balcony shots, some of them were shot there, then the rest of it was shot in the studio, because we did pick up that pool piece.
Dink, meet Felix Leiter.
Hello.
Felix, say hello to Dink.
Hi, Dink.
Dink, say goodbye to Felix.
Goldfinger has one of the most efficient film beginnings in history. James Bond's character and persona is well established, as is his universe. The poolside beauties at the Fontainebleau are only one example, but notice how there are no families, no children, no retired East Coast couples here at the Fontainebleau. It is all the beautiful people, part of James Bond's world. Bond's sexual energy is shown with such speed and ease that no one questions the absurdity of it all. First, we meet Naja Regine as the dancer at the club in Mexico. Next, Bond has a playmate poolside with Dink. Then we have the young, attractive maid as Bond goes into the hallway at the Fontainebleau, and next Shirley Eaton, the beauty he meets on the balcony, who will soon be painted gold. All this is necessary to make James Bond's rapid seduction of Joel Masterson, played by Shirley Eaton, believable for an audience. Ian Fleming's novel begins quite differently than the film Goldfinger. The novel Goldfinger was one of Ian Fleming's best-selling novels and one of the best written. Author Anthony Burgess, author of A Clockwork Orange, listed it as among his favorite English-language novels of the mid-20th century. But the novel contains significant differences to the film, many of which were vital improvements. Bond's Mexican adventure is told in flashback as James Bond sits at a bar in the Miami airport. The chapter is called Reflections in a Double Bourbon, and Bond's attitude towards killing is explored, and the way it makes him feel. James Bond has just killed a Mexican bandit, quite a different way than he does at the opening of this film. It is some of Fleming's most evocative writing. The death has no casual throwaway lines which would become a hallmark of the James Bond films. Instead, it is deep and serious. Later, when we get back to the main story of Goldfinger, Bond is approached by the man who's now playing bridge at the Fontainebleau, and he is asked to stay in the most expensive hotel in Miami and have a wonderful dinner if he'll help him figure out how Goldfinger is cheating him at cards. James Bond also sleeps with Joel Masterson, not in Miami, but on a train to New York. He leaves her there, and she returns to Goldfinger. It is only later, when Bond meets Jill's sister Tilly, that he discovers Jill's fate. Bond screenwriter Richard Maybaum, working with producers Broccoli and Saltzman, made the most of these improvements, using basic screenwriting rules, particularly that it is always better in films to be shown information as an audience rather than have it told to you. For many moviegoers, composer John Barry's music is synonymous with the character James Bond. He recalls his work on Goldfinger.
Goldfinger, to me, is the most favorite, and it was the first time I was allowed to do everything. I was allowed to do the song, the whole score, whatever. And also, but everything else came together in Goldfinger. Ken Adams' design, the opening title scene, the whole Bond formula, which it indeed was, it culminated in Goldfinger. I mean, that was it. That was the setup. And everything else down the line, that was the Bible from then on. So it was my favorite. And because it was the first that really came together, it's only on reflection, looking back, that you see what that meant. At the time, it was, it seemed very spontaneous.
Now hear this, Goldfinger
was... When you first listen to it, you say, well, what the hell are you going to do with Goldfinger? But as Guy Hamilton pointed out, it's a song about a villain, and I suppose the obvious song about a villain, the obvious classic song about a villain, was Mac the Knight. So once I got that straightened out, that's what it was going to be, I went to Anthony Newley, actually, and... said, would you like to write the lyric? And he worked with Leslie Bricus. And then he said, well, you know, my relationship with Leslie, I write the music, Leslie writes the lyrics. So I said, what is Goldfinger? I said, it's a song about a villain. In terms of Shirley to sing it, I love the idea of Shirley because, well, number one, at that time, Shirley was a huge star in England. I know she wasn't in the United States, but she was in England. And Shirley, getting back to what I said initially about Sean, this thing of conviction. Shirley didn't come in and read this lyric and say, well, what's the meaning? And, you know, she just...
I know the best place in town.
Sang it. She sang the notes. She sang the words. And you were convinced. There were about 20 other recordings of Goldfinger. Other people covered it. None of them came anywhere near... because they all tried to do something else with it, or what? Shirley just went, oh, I mean, you've got it. And it was the conviction that made the song work. If we'd have had somebody less than Shirley, that song wouldn't have worked.
And that makes two of us. Oh, Felix.
Well,
now. What's that? Dinner? No, look, I'm sorry. I can't. Something big's come up.
Right.
Well, how about breakfast?
Okay.
Not too early.
I'll call you around 9.
Yes, 9 o'clock will be fine.
So long, James.
Good night, Felix. Oh, it's lost its chill.
Why, you...
Sorry, there's another in the fridge.
Who needs it?
My dear girl, there are some things that just aren't done. Such as drinking Dom Perignon 53 above a temperature of 38 degrees Fahrenheit. That's as bad as listening to the Beatles without earmuffs. Now, where is this passion? It's 79432. Room 119.
Hello?
Hello, Felix. Get over here right away.
What's up?
The girl's dead.
Dink?
Masterson. Jill Masterson. And she's covered in paint. Gold paint.
And now we're back to London, in a shot that somewhat matches the intro to Miami used earlier in the film. We're going to M's office at Universal Export, also known as Her Majesty's Secret Service. Of particular note here, aside from the wonderful interplay between actors Bernard Lee and Sean Connery, is Sean Connery's suit. Connery's suits for the early Bond films were tailored by Anthony Sinclair, a Savile Row tailor, who also happened to be the tailor of director Terence Young, directed 3 of the first 4 James Bond films. Even the shirts took particular attention. They were manufactured by world-renowned shirt manufacturer Turnbull and Asser of London. This type of attention to fine detail is one of the things that made James Bond seem so authentically erudite, sophisticated, and one of the most popular fictional characters of the 20th century.
Sir, I'm aware of my shortcomings, but I'm prepared to continue this assignment in the spirit you suggest, if I knew what it was about. Sir.
What do you know about gold, not paint, bullion?
I know it when I see it.
Meet me here at 7. Black tie.
And what do you know about gold money, Penny?
Oh, the only gold I know about is the kind you wear. You know, on the third finger of your left hand.
Hmm. Well, one of these days, we really must look into that.
Well, what about tonight? You come around for dinner, and I'll cook you a beautiful angel cake.
Well, nothing would give me greater pleasure, but unfortunately, I do have a business appointment.
That's the flimsiest excuse you've ever given me. Ah, well, some girls have all the luck. Who is she, James?
She is me, Miss Moneypenny.
And kindly omit the customary byplay with 007. He's dining with me.
I don't want him to be late.
So there's hope for me yet.
Moneypenny. Won't you ever believe me?
We here at the Bank of England, Mr. Bond, are the official depository for gold bullion, just as Fort Knox, Kentucky, is for the United States. We know, of course, the amounts we each hold. We know the amounts deposited in other banks, and we can estimate what is being held for industrial purposes. Now, this enables the two governments to establish, respectively, the true value of the dollar and the pound. Consequently, we are vitally concerned with unauthorized leakages.
I take it you mean smuggling?
Yes. Gold, gentlemen, which can be melted down and recast, is virtually untraceable, which makes it, unlike diamonds, ideal for smuggling, attracting the biggest and most ingenious criminals. Thank you, Brunstall. That'll be all.
Thank you, sir.
Have a little more of this rather disappointing brandy.
Well, what's the matter with it?
I'd say it was a 30-year-old fiend indifferently blended, sir.
With an overdose of bon bois.
Colonel Smithers is giving the lecture, 007.
Gentlemen, Mr. Goldfinger has gold bullion on deposit in Zurich, Amsterdam, Caracas, and Hong Kong. Worth £20 million. Most of it came from this country.
Well, why move it?
Because the price of gold varies from country to country. If you buy it here at $30 an ounce, you can sell it in, say, Pakistan at $110 and triple your money. Providing, of course, you have the facilities for melting it down.
And has he?
Apart from being a legitimate bullion dealer, Mr. Goldfinger poses... No, that's not quite fair. Is, among his many other interests, a legitimate international jeweler. He's legally entitled to operate modest metallurgical installations. His British one is down in Kent. As yet, we have failed to discover how he transfers his gold overseas. And Lord knows we've tried. If your department can establish that it is done illegally, then the bank can institute proceedings to recover the bulk of his holdings.
I think it's time Mr. Goldfinger and I met. Socially, of course.
I was hoping you'd say that.
It might lead to a business talk. Mr. Goldfinger's kind of business.
I need some sort of bait.
I quite agree. This is the only one we have from the Nazi horde at the bottom of Lake Toplitz in the Salzkammergut. But there are undoubtedly others. Mr. Bond can make whatever use of it he thinks fit. Providing he returns it, of course.
Now on to another James Bond tradition, Q's lab. After the popularity of Bond's trick briefcase, In From Russia With Love, the producers decided to go all out with the character of Q and his lethal gadgets. Part of the fun of the world of espionage is that things are not what they seem milieu, and Q represents this brilliantly. Stuntman George Leach remembers his involvement with this scene.
I think my first experience of being shot by one of Q's inventions in their cellar somewhere, in their wherever they did their tricks in Q's workshop, and I was one of the victims. They stuck a moustache on me, so I wouldn't be recognised, or something else they did, and had the bullet effects, the machine gun effects, shot it. Oh, this is a new bulletproof vest we've got, or something. I had all these explosions. My first experience, I think, of a special effects being really close up.
Now, pay attention, please.
The man responsible for the initial design of many of Q's gadgets is production designer extraordinaire Ken Adam.
Valid all countries. Here's a nice little
trunk. Lemming had talked about the green label Bentley, which Bond used to drive. And both Harry and Cubby thought that that was too old hat. And it gave us an opportunity to publicize or use one of the latest British sports cars. And the Aston Martin in those days had more class than the Jaguar, so we decided on the Aston Martin. But it was also interesting because I approached Aston Martin at the time, and they were not at all keen to let us have one, and we needed two Aston Martins for all that stuff. They wanted to be paid a lot of money and so on. And, of course, after the film came out and was successful and their sales went up by 60%, I was told. From that moment on, we never had any problems, like later on the Lotus or some of the other cars, to get help from the car manufacturers.
Smoke screen, oil slick, rear bulletproof screen, and left...
Let's look at a little bit of the history of the most famous car in the world, James Bond's Aston Martin DB5. James Bond did drive an Aston Martin in the novel Goldfinger, It wasn't his personal car. It was his company car. He drove the model DB3. In this case, Bond drove the DB5, and it proved to be the most successful merchandising tie-in in film history, not just for the car's manufacturer, Aston Martin, but also for a company called Corgi. Corgi Toys manufactured the miniature Aston Martins with all of the gadgets available on them. The tie-in proved to be so successful that Corgi Toys has sold more Aston Martin James Bond toy cars than Aston Martin has ever sold their full-size vehicles in the entire history of the company. The car itself is a remarkable story as well. The car that has the gadgets on it in Goldfinger was actually the development prototype Aston Martin DB5. It is the same car which can be seen in the advertising brochures produced by Aston Martin in 1963 and 64, at that point painted red, and also the same car which was seen at the Earl's Court Motor Show, which initially attracted the attention of the filmmakers. This car had the license registration BMT 216A. After it was outfitted with gadgets and tens of thousands of pounds were poured into it, filmmakers knew they needed another Aston Martin for shots where Bond's lethal gadgets are not used. They purchased a second car, license plate number FMP7B. Bond aficionados have spent far too much time trying to figure out which car was used in which shots. Now the secrets can be revealed. The effects car has a small gold reflector near the air intake on the side of the Aston Martin. Also, the license plate housings on the two cars are quite different. Both cars were used in the next James Bond film, Thunderball. After the huge success of Goldfinger, there was a public clamor to see the Aston Martin, to actually be able to look at James Bond's remarkable gadget car, and the Aston Martin went on tour. The stand-in Aston Martin was also outfitted with gadgets, as were two additional DB5s. For years, these cars toured the globe.
Yes, from the same source. Interesting.
In the late 1960s, as James Bond mania finally began to relax, the Aston Martins owned by Eon Productions were sold. BMT 216A, the original gadget car, had always been owned by the Aston Martin Company. In 1968, they decided to sell the car as well. First, though, they removed all the remarkable James Bond gadgets. Collectors quickly got wind of the chassis number and understood that this was the car that had been used in Goldfinger. The car was purchased, new gadgets were installed, and has been successfully shown at many auto shows and James Bond conventions in the intervening years. As of 1995, three of the four original James Bond Aston Martins are now housed in the United States. One is owned by radio station owner Jerry Lee. That's FMP7B. The original gadget car, BMT 216A, is owned by Anthony Puglisi, a real estate developer. And lastly, one of the touring cars is on display at a car museum in Tennessee. For the complete story on the James Bond Aston Martins, Dave Worrell's impeccably researched book, The Most Famous Car in the World, makes compelling reading.
No, it's not. He plays a Slazenger 1.
Strict rules of golf, Goldfinger. 5 minutes are almost up. The lost ball will cost you stroke and distance. Aha!
Uh-oh. I'm still training him as a caddy.
Successfully, too.
Slazenger number one? Good.
If that's his original ball, I'm Arnold Palmer.
It isn't.
How do you know?
I'm standing on it.
Why, you crafty old...
Leave it.
The ball you found, sir?
Yes, Slazenger 7. Let's have a little fun with Mr. Goldfinger.
Like me to mark it or knock it in?
Mm-hmm.
Play it. This 4.5.
That's right.
One to go. That'll be the clincher.
Fine.
Did you switch him, sir?
Uh-huh.
Then we've got him.
If he doesn't notice a switch.
It's your honor, sir.
It's all right.
Down in five.
I have to sink this to half the game, right? Yeah. You win, Goldfinger.
It seems I'm too good for you.
You play a Schlesinger one, don't you?
Yes, why?
This is a Schlesinger seven. Here's my pinfold hearts. You must have played the wrong ball somewhere on the 18th fairway. We are playing strict rules, so I'm afraid you lose the hole and the match.
Peter Lamont recalls his favorite memory of actor Harold Sakata.
Another amusing anecdote with Goldfinger. Do you remember when Goldfinger says farewell to Bond at the golf course? And he mentioned something and he said, odd job, show him. And odd job takes his bow around and goes whang like that, and he hits the statue's head off. Well, second unit went to do this in Pinewood Gardens. And after about 30 or 40 takes, they couldn't get near the damn thing. And Harold was finishing that afternoon. And he went over, and Tony Perry was the director. And he said, Harold, I've just come to say goodbye. He said, do me a favour, throw the hat once. He threw the hat and hit the head. Just like that.
Remarkable. But what does the club secretary have to say?
Oh, nothing, Mr. Bond. I own the club. I assume you want the check made out to cash.
Now let's meet two lesser-known members of the James Bond family, special effects technicians Joe Fitt and Burt Luxford, who worked at Pinewood Studios in the 60s and 70s.
My name's Joe Fitt. I used to work at special effects. I've worked on the first six James Bond films.
My name's Burt Luxford. My colleague, I've worked on the first six James Bond films.
I don't know where the idea came up, because at the time, I think Cleetson Kane was the art director, wasn't he?
That's right.
And he's the one that approached me about doing some of the work on the car, with, of course, John Steers and Joe, and in those days, Jimmy Snow and
Frank George.
Both passed away, unfortunately, but... But the ideas themselves were, I believe, basically the art department's idea. The mechanics were left to us. There was no design on the mechanics at all, how it was done. And in those days, of course, as you can appreciate, we hadn't got the transistor chips and all those type of things to work with. We had to do everything manually, which was a little bit more... sort of involved work-wise, where it could have all been done with a microchip on most of it. We had to make things and actually build them in ourselves, you know, which of course was a very, very long-winded process.
It was reconstructed. We made the sort of mock-ups at first, and then afterwards it was reconstructed, you know, to the actual thing that you see in the car now.
Because the actual car now, I don't think is in existence anymore. At least I was told it wasn't. Because it wasn't roadworthy anyhow. It wouldn't have been good enough to take out on a dual carriageway or something like that. It worked, but, you know, we had to drill holes in the chassis for the overriders to to come out. They were on hydraulics in those days. Again, electrics were not really far advanced enough in the very small stage to do them in with, well, if you could put it with a bit of string, put it with a bit of string.
Joe Fitt and Bert Luxford worked for effects genius John Steers. John Steers got his start in the 1950s, working on such films as In Search of the Castaways and The Three Lives of Thomasina. He worked on Damn the Defiant and as Frank George's assistant in 1962 on the first James Bond film, Dr. No. Steers' main contribution to Dr. No was the miniature explosion of Dr. No's docks on the Crab Key Island at the climax of the film, an explosion which holds up well today, over 30 years after it was done. By the next year, 1963, Steers had moved up the ladder and was now head of special effects on Call Me Buona, the Broccoli and Saltzman-produced comedy starring Bob Hope. Later that year, John Steers supervised the effects on From Russia with Love, a hugely complex film which included effects of a boat chase on burning water, miniature helicopters, and spectacular pyrotechnics. Next on the agenda for Steers was Goldfinger. Goldfinger would prove to be a very complex film as well, particularly with the Aston Martin. The effects on the car were difficult to control and difficult to manage. One of the most complex of these effects was the tire scythe, which was inspired by the chariot race sequence from Ben-Hur. John Steers now explains how the effect was pulled off.
The actual tire slashing apparatus we didn't do on the car as such. That the actual knife that came out was done back in the studios through a hollow shaft. We couldn't have done that with the real car because the torque would have smashed it anyhow, so we had to do it different ways. So we did it in bits. In Switzerland on location, I had another knife which actually bolted onto to the wheel, where the actual nut that holds the wheel on. That was a really extended shaft, chrome to look like the thing. And we got that as close as we could to the Mustang. And we'd put aluminum foil down the side of the Mustang, painted that, and ripped that up visually by hand to make it like it was torn up. But the on location, those two things didn't actually touch together. But all that touching was done actually in the studios. I built a rig on rails. Built the sides of the car in fiberglass, both the Aston Martin and the Mustang, the bits we're going to see. And where the actual bit was pulled up, I did that in a zinc panel, and the blade actually came out on the other side, like through the wheel, rotated, and it actually did plow through the zinc as it was going along the road. And because that was done with Traveller Mac 2, so that was a TM shot, so you saw the background behind it, and that's how the two things put together. And of course, with the superb editing by Peter Hunt, who has to take an awful lot of credit for the Bond pictures with his editing. He's a genius.
What's your name, by the way?
Soames. Tilly Soames.
Here for the hunting season? I had a case just like that one.
It's for my ice skates.
Lovely sport. Where do you skate?
St. Moritz.
I didn't know there was...
The genius of editor Peter Hunt has inspired legions of film editors over the years. But much to his annoyance, fans have taken great pleasure in finding minor incongruities in the Bond films. For car buffs, the most glaring is the issue of the sun visor in the DB5.
It'll take 24 hours to get new tires. There's a hotel nearby.
Oh, jump in, I'll run you down.
That won't be necessary.
Well, I hate to leave you here alone.
I can take care of
myself. It was said that Harry came up during that garage
scene. And while that other car, new car was there, they took the mock-up one away, Harry turned around and said, well, where's the Aston Martin? And somebody said, I suggested to Harry that somebody had taken it down to the canteen to get some sandwiches, the clapper loader. And Harry nearly had a heart attack.
Peter Lamont recalls how the locations in Switzerland and England were cleverly integrated for this sequence.
The chase around, obviously, that you know, the chase around Enterprise's Ulrich was shot in a pine wood, but the actual factory was in Switzerland. It was the Pilatus factory, you know, the Pilatus airplane factory. And they just, again, went out there for a weekend with the Aston Martin, took the car out and the Goldfinger's Rolls Royce, did those shots, came back, we carried on shooting.
The man most responsible for seamlessly cutting together these disparate locations is editor Peter Hunt.
This was the one sequence that Guy Hamilton was very worried about, and he came to me and we talked about it. But it worked very well. He was concerned, really, about how we would show Bond seeing the Ulrich factory. Not this original part, which in fact was the first things that were shot on the film. So it was all rather done out of continuity. And I think that's what worried him a little bit. However, it all worked very well, I must say. And for the latter part of this sequence, it was all done at Pinewood, all that car business around the houses, as it were. Because once we got away from what we had shown as the Ulrich factory, it didn't matter where you went then. Once we'd established ourselves here in Pinewood and this was a set, then we were home and dry. Off we went.
That thing that I've just seen on there now, the gold, the melting into gold, that was not, as you can appreciate, real heat. The actual thing is made, the crystal thing was made out of fiberglass with a light inside it.
Oh, yes.
Mm. And the actual gold, of course, wasn't gold. I mean, it would be too dangerous because there were actors doing it and you couldn't have molten metal of any description on the set. We had to get some false gold, molten gold.
Did they use gold wax?
It was gold powder mixed with some.
Yeah.
And of course, a little bit of car ice in it to make
the smoke. That's the only thing we did put in, I think, was the smoke.
He goes there through the fence, in fact, of Pinewood Studios. That's the back lot, as it were, and we use that, and naturally at night you can't see very much, so at least you can get the light in there so that you get all the mystery about it. But I get him there quite conveniently and smoothly, because if you notice in the earlier sequence, in the earlier part where he gets out of the factory, I use mixes, very quick mixes, which is much smoother to get him from one location to another.
Kill who?
Goldfinger!
Well, I want him alive.
I want him dead. He killed my sister.
D.M. Dilly Masters. I knew your sister Jill. I know what he did to her in Miami.
No, you don't. Let me go.
If you wanted to kill him, why did you shoot at me?
I didn't. I was shooting at him.
Well, you're a lousy shot. It's somebody else around here, isn't it? Come on.
In this suspenseful moment, of course, we go into what was originally the beginning of the shoot.
I'll take care of him.
That's right. They get into the car and off they go. Now we go back to Pinewood Studios and round the stages of Pinewood Studios. And some of it was speeded up in the camera. Some of it I speeded up. And we tried to make it as exciting as one could. I think that by trying to get a suspenseful opening to it, such as the wire and suddenly finding the girl there, it helped do all that. And of course, at the same time, I had to get in all this trickery without, which has its amusing quality, of course, for the audience, but without destroying a certain amount of excitement that is coming.
First of all, we're going to have 6-inch nails all folded up, you know, with points sticking out and everything. And apparently somebody got to hear about this, the Home Office, and I said no, because otherwise other people would copy this.
That's after I'd made about 50 of the damn things, wasn't
that? That's right, yeah.
And it.
And the oil, I think they were going to ban that. That's coloured water.
Coloured water, yes. Yeah, this is the bit that we've done.
In the quarry.
In the quarry.
Yeah. That, then it goes into the.
It goes into the wall. That was done at the time. Actually, that wall's still there. So it's the hill behind it, actually, isn't it?
Is it still there?
Because
I say I haven't been here for ages.
We had to get some sort of rhythm into this chase. Because, you know, if you don't rely on sound and the sort of tempo of cutting, it's fairly placid shots. And if you know, I use the sound there enormously in order to make sure that you get that's the end of the end of the road, as it were, with the precipice dropping down for miles. Now we come into some, you know, the real action stuff, so you keep this moving at a great pace, and with the sound of it, you just keep everything alive and going, which adds to the excitement of her getting away, and now you suddenly get boom! And there's the villain with a through that, and I put a lovely sound on her neck breaking. And here he's captured, so we start to slow the pace down. Audience know that they're going to get him. And naturally, this is a tender moment, so one has to really ease any tension, any speed, other than the tension between him and the girl. With my great friend Oddjob. I used to lunch with Oddjob every day. One day I said to him, I'm afraid I'm going to have to revoice you. He said, huh? Huh? And that's all he ever says in the film. And then he grinned all over his face. He was a very sweet man. I really don't know whose idea this was, but it was tremendous. It was very good. She was terrific, this lovely old gal.
And now for one of the most memorable and spectacular gadgets in any film ever. John Steers talks about the ejector seat.
The ejector seat, that was rigged, obviously, because the chassis would have taken a proper ejector seat, and the guy next, the driver, would have got burnt anyhow, so I used compressed air on that and a lightweight dummy.
And now Joe Fitt and Burt Luxford discuss one of the most dangerous stunts in the film, the crash of the Aston Martin.
I think the one thing that was very disheartening as far as we all were concerned was the fact that we'd worked on this car for something like 4.5 months before we got anywhere near completion. And the first night shooting, they said, oh, this car's got to go through a brick wall. Yes. Yeah. The thing is, I hadn't told the stuntman that was driving it that there was some steel construction behind the brick wall. He did it perfectly. But if he'd been about, oh, I think a foot out, he would have gone straight through the front of the car, wouldn't he? With it?
Oh, yeah.
But he actually hit one side of the car.
George Leach was responsible for driving the car into the wall.
I only did the driving the Aston Martin between the stages here. Yeah, they said to me, don't damage the car. Crash the car into the wall, as you see it. Don't damage the car, whatever you do, because you've got all these gadgets on it. So I had to be fast but careful.
The stunt was shot twice. The first time, Leach drove far too far through the wall, almost crashing into some metal grating on the other side. That take can be seen in the film's trailer.
I had to take the car only a certain distance in the wall so that the door could be opened by Oddjob as Bond falls out through the door, just hangs upside down, unconscious.
At this point, the film takes a serious departure from the novel. Bond's accomplice, Tilly Masterson, is still alive at this point, and in fact, lives almost to the end of the novel. But now, James Bond is left alone, a valued improvement over Fleming's original.
My name is James Bond.
Well, the table was actually made by an outside company, I don't know. But the actual sheets that you see there, which are gold, supposedly gold, underneath, when the laser was actually an optical put on afterwards, but believe it or not, that light that went round it was not fluorescent tubes as everybody thinks they are. They're not. It was a very, very powerful light. You couldn't get within about 6 inches of it before you got a flash coming off of it. You know, it's very dangerous indeed. So the laser was put on as an optical afterwards, I believe, Carly did that. That's the tubes I was thinking of. Mm. They were very dangerous indeed.
That was special effects technician Bert Luxford, and now to Cliff Cully.
This is the laser gun that John had made. Again, Bert Luxford and the boys, but we put all the beams on afterwards.
This is gold, Mr. Bond.
It's funny watching this sequence again after all these years. All the dialogue, because you're on the stage so many times and they do various takes, the dialogue comes back to you. You know, I can always remember that Gert Frobe had a lot of trouble with his line when Bond's laying on the bed of gold and it's being cut. And he said, "Choose your next witticism carefully, 007. And because he was German, he kept tripping over that line, witticism. And they must have shot it all quite a few times. It all comes back to you now. We had a real laser beam brought in from a scientific company which looked fine when they demonstrated it in a darkened stage, but of course as soon as you put all the studio lights on, the laser beam disappeared. It was so fine and so slight that it didn't stand up against the studio light. So that's when we had to do all the optical stuff. And as I say, it was all done afterwards, all done in post-production. Sean wasn't too keen about that shot because we had an acetylene torch underneath the... John Steers rigged up an acetylene torch underneath the strip of brass which was used as the gold, and Sean's laying on there and it's coming closer and closer up his legs. He wasn't too keen about that.
This scene is considered one of the classic moments in films. It is probably the most memorable villain confrontation ever filmed, and it marks a turning point in this movie. Up until this point, James Bond has been unbeatable. Every beautiful woman has been seduced, every villain has been vanquished, including Goldfinger, for Bond has bested the man twice. This is very different from most larger-than-life action films. The standard approach is to spend the first half of the film building up the villain, making him seem so ominous and undefeatable that the audience wonders how the hero could possibly prevail. In Goldfinger, screenwriters Richard Maybaum and Paul Dinn turn the tables on this formula. From here on, James Bond is Goldfinger's prisoner and has precious little to do with the story and with Goldfinger's plot. Therein lies the genius of this scene. With some of the sharpest dialogue ever written, Maybaum and Dinn totally turn the tables on 007. Goldfinger has won. James Bond can only make a quick, clever gambit for his life, and even then, he ends up as Goldfinger's prisoner. In this one scene, the filmmakers transform Goldfinger from an unsuccessful cheat at cards and golf to a larger-than-life, megalomaniacal villain. This point in the film is where the screenwriters totally depart from Fleming's novel. In the parallel scene to the laser table sequence in Fleming's original, Bond is hired by Goldfinger as an assistant, along with Tilly Masterson, after Goldfinger fails to understand Bond's Secret Service connection. Maybaum, the master of plotting, as usual, finds more logical reasons for Goldfinger to keep James Bond alive.
Richard Maybaum's ability to improve over Ian Fleming's plots made him a perfect choice to bring James Bond to the screen. By killing off Tilly Masterson quickly, Maybaum eliminates an awkward lesbian subplot in the novel, which fails to pay off and succeeds only in offending modern sensibilities. For in the novel Goldfinger, James Bond sets out his theory of homosexuality, which is laughably bizarre. Fleming has Bond theorizing that much of the sexual confusion in society began, believe it or not, when women were given the vote. What makes these comments all the more incredible is that Fleming was platonic friends with many openly homosexual men, most notably Noel Coward. But these passages in the novel reveal some of the odd dynamic which makes Fleming's reading so compelling. He was both a sexual revolutionary and a prude, a free spirit environmentalist, and a staunch conservative. He was an individualist who remained in the naval reserves most of his life. And it is just those disparate qualities which make James Bond such a compelling character. In short, we know James Bond is his own man, while also being the loyal servant of the Queen.
Period.
Well, that's good news. And by the way, where is our host?
He flew on ahead.
Thank you. Yes, to Operation Grand Slam.
We have just passed one of the most famous introductions in screen history. Meet Pussy Galore, the ultimate Bond woman. Whatever aspects of her character may exist, she has, in the person of Honor Blackman, become a cultural icon. In the novel, we discover that Pussy Galore is the leader of an all-female crime gang called the Cement Mixers. Tilly Masterson takes a liking to Miss Galore, only to be killed in the end of the novel. Pussy Galore survives, and in the last couple of pages, confesses that her life of homosexuality and crime stemmed from a childhood rape. She now feels she has met a real man in Bond and is ready to convert to heterosexuality. It is all very well written, but rather thin. The filmmakers have a little bit more fun with the hinted homosexuality, surrounding Honor Blackman with beautiful women who serve as a visual reference to her desires. She is also given lines like, "You can turn off the charm. I'm immune." Story-wise, writer Richard Maybaum makes this work wonderfully well. Up until now in the film, James Bond has been able to use his sex appeal as a weapon. But here, he is confronted with a woman who has no interest in him. The whole situation is absurd, but James Bond's universe has been so completely created that the audience takes an immediate interest in the outcome of this encounter. This brings us to the subject of Bond women in general. There has probably never been a more maligned group of characters over the past 30 years than the women who populate the James Bond films. One of the conceits of the films is that Secret Agent 007 is irresistible, far more so than he is in the novels. Fortunately, the filmmakers knew how to define his charm. The filmmakers also knew how to cast the role of the women who would play opposite Sean Connery. While there is no arguing that James Bond treats women as sexual objects in the films, many of the Bond women are surprisingly strong. In Dr. No, the first Bond film, the first woman we meet is a gambler named Sylvia Trench. She takes the initiative with Bond and breaks into his London home. Later, Bond sets a date with Dr. No's agent, Miss Taro, who willingly sleeps with 007 so that another of Dr. No's operatives will have the chance to kill him. As can be seen, these women have their own agendas. Honey Ryder, memorably played by Ursula Andress, also has her own agenda, but proves resourceful, if superstitious. In From Rush with Love, the entire film is based on a specter trap, wherein a Russian cipher clerk falls in love with James Bond's photograph. The conceit seems more to be based on James Bond's ego than anything else. Of course, Bond and Tatiana do fall into a romantic relationship, but this is slowly developed over the course of the film. In Goldfinger, the sexuality explodes. While many of the beautiful women in the film do seem to be there for decorative purposes only, the central characters are actually quite strong. Jill Masterson sees Bond as her way out from under Goldfinger's thumb. Tilly Masterson never becomes a romantic interest, maintaining her focus on killing Goldfinger. And finally, we meet Pussy Galore, who has her own agenda. Certainly, she falls for Bond in the end, but only after screenwriter Maybaum gives us a clever hint
that she may be having serious doubts about Goldfinger's ability to pull off his grand scheme. While there is a strong dose of sexism in the early Bond films, you do not see these female characters sitting about helplessly as James Bond goes on his adventure. Each plays a part in the plot, and each has a set of goals that are quite different than Bond's. Part of what makes these female characters so engaging is that they are strong, smart, and independent. Part of the objection to the role of Bond women in the films has been that they appear to be there just so that James Bond can seduce them for his own purposes. This is true. James Bond is a sexual carnivore, but he follows a long tradition of such characters. For as long as fiction has been written, both male and female writers have told tales of women coldly seducing men for their own gain. The men, for the promise of uncomplicated sex, have been easy prey. The filmic incarnation of James Bond created a male character who was just as capable of using sex as a weapon while still maintaining a voracious appetite. The central difference is that most of the fictional women who have used sex as a weapon have been portrayed as villainesses, while Bond manages to remain a hero. Therein lies the true double standard.
My life, will you see everything before I need to go? Of course, and I'll see you inside.
Peter Hunt not only edited the first five Bond films, he also did second unit on them, and of course directed the sixth Bond film on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Well, second unit directing generally amounted to a great deal of inserts and a number of shots to pull the film together more and get the whole, you know, for certainly the first six moving as I wanted to have it move. I used close-ups of various gadgets and things like that. And the director really didn't care to waste time, as he put it, on having those lovely hats go through the air and catch the statue and knock the statue. So I was doing all that sort of stuff and killing the girl. And then, of course, when it came to the point where Goldfinger gets sucked out the window and difficult things like that, that took time and a certain amount of technical ability. And, of course, they had to look right and they had to fit into the film. And as I was busy editing it at the same time, I knew exactly what I want. And therefore, I was able to pick up bits and pieces and shots and close-ups. I generally hate inserts, and if you look at any of the Bonds, all the Bond enthusiasts, you'll see that what I like to do is to make an insert with part of a human in them, such as the whole hand there, or the arm, or part of the leg, or whatever, you know, from that point of view. I don't care just to have, you know, a close-up of a gun, or a close-up of a diary, or something like that. I like to have some sort of, you know, human movement with it, so that it slips in. And you'll see many, you probably won't even notice them, because if they work properly, you shouldn't notice them. It should all become part of the timing of the whole film.
Ah! Welcome to Oryxstadt, Mr. Bond. Lovely animal, isn't she?
Certainly better bred than the owner.
Sure, Mr. Bond, to his quarters, please.
Maybe we should just drop in on him.
He'll shout if he needs us.
They're all here, Mr. Goldfinger.
Huh?
Oh, yes. Yes. Thank you, Kit.
That guy Solo's gonna wear a hole in his shoes.
All right. Hey. I'm gonna move here. Here we go.
Yeah, hoist it.
Gentlemen! Goldfinger, why weren't we told that New York and the West Coast were in on this?
Look who's talking.
I do not do business with Chicago.
I thought we had a private business deal to settle. Now I find I'm attending our Hood's convention.
Goldfinger, I made a delivery. Where is my money?
I made a delivery, too.
You all made the deliveries we contracted for. And you owe me $1 million. I owe each of you $1 million. In gold bullion.
So pay!
This scene proved to be one of the most difficult from a storytelling point of view. Here, Goldfinger must tell the audience and his gathered group of criminals his grand scheme. Richard Maybaum is helped out of this common screenwriting trap by one of the most ingenious sets in film history, designed, of course, by Ken Adam. All of the special effects, moving set pieces, rotating bits of furniture, help disguise the other problems with the sequence, which become apparent on repeat viewings. In particular, why would Goldfinger explain his scheme to a group of men whom he plans to kill? There's one very good reason for Goldfinger to go to all this trouble, because it works for the film. This whole explanation sequence not only sets up Goldfinger's plan, it also makes the reversal that Goldfinger has no intention of stealing the gold at Fort Knox all the more entertaining.
What's that map doing there?
This is my bank. The gold depository at Fort Knox, gentlemen. In its vaults are $15 billion. The entire gold supply of the United States.
Knock off Fort Knox?
Got a key or something?
Of a kind. There are 35,000 troops stationed around there. 41,000.
And who's going to say boo to them, Goldfinger?
Hey, what's going on here?
What is it?
Hey.
On the floor, right there.
Has climbed Mount Everest, gone to the bottom of the ocean. He has fired rockets to the moon, split the atom, achieved miracles in every field of human endeavor, except crime!
Director Guy Hamilton has put together a very clever piece of business here. During the fight, watch carefully as Bond and the guard get into it. The Korean guard will suddenly sprout longer and fuller hair. That's because he is none other than stunt coordinator and stuntman Bob Simmons.
And the vault will rock with applause for centuries.
Catholic commercial.
Yeah, get to the point.
You're wasting my time, Goldfinger. The depository is impregnable.
Look, the joint is bombproof, electrified, lousy with
machines. Bear with me, TV, please. Fort Knox is a bank, like any other. Larger, better protected, perhaps, but nonetheless, a bank. It can be, I think the expression is blown. My plan is foolproof, gentlemen. I call it Operation Grand Slam. I have devoted 15 years of my life to it. Every detail has been scrupulously prepared. Every eventuality has been considered. We will operate on a split-second schedule.
Your organization, Mr. Midnight, brought a consignment of these canisters across the Canadian border.
They contain Delta 9.
Delta 9?
What's that? An invisible nerve gas, which disperses 15 minutes after inducing complete unconsciousness for 24 hours. Tomorrow at dawn, the flying circus of my personal pilot, Miss Pussy Galore, will spray it into the atmosphere. Once the population, including the military, has been immobilized, my task force, which Mr. Strap and his people smuggled across the Rio Grande from Mexico, will approach Fort Knox in motorized equipment along Bullion Boulevard, which runs past the depository here and intersects with Gold Vault Road. This fence surrounding the depository, as Mr. Strap reminded us, is electrified. It will be dynamited. My task force will then move to the main entrance and demolish it.
How, may I ask?
You made that possible, Mr. Solo, by arranging through your considerable influence in shipping circles to bring through customs uninspected a consignment labeled machine parts. All that will then remain is to descend to the vaults, where the bullion is stored.
I've heard enough.
Let him...
If you have no objection, I'll take my money now.
What's the matter, Solo? Too big for you to handle?
Gentlemen, we must respect Mr. Solo's decision. Please excuse me for a few minutes while I take care of him. Make yourselves comfortable.
Despite concerns over censors, filmmakers had a great deal of fun with the name Pussy Galore, having Connery utter it at every opportunity.
Pussy? Now, who taught you judo?
The gun you took.
On the guns.
Set designer Ken Adam also had a great deal of fun with the sets. He recalls his designs and his purpose with the Rumpus Room.
Well, you know, the script called for a stud for Goldfinger's stud farm in Kentucky somewhere. And this room was called the Rumpus Room. And it had to transform in a way, because when Goldfinger gets rid of all his henchmen who are being gassed, so that gave me all sorts of opportunities of roofs coming down, the model coming out of the floor and so on, fireplace coming down. And I just, you know, designed it, and it was a lot of fun designing it.
To keep the action moving, cinematographer Ted Moore introduces some expressionistic lighting techniques. There is no logical explanation why blue lights are suddenly flashing on this set, but they do make it seem more ominous and dangerous in the killing of the gangsters.
Such a pity you did not choose to remain with the others, Mr. Solo. However, ah, Mr. Bond, I thought you were resting in your quarters.
Oh, they are delightful, but it's much too nice to stay indoors.
I ran into Miss Galore, and she suggested that we join you. Mr. Solo, Mr. Bond, another of my distinguished guests.
Hello.
Leaving us so soon, Mr. Solo?
Unfortunately, he has a pressing engagement.
Yeah. I'd like to get started, Goldfinger. Boy.
When you gotta go, you gotta go. My plane will get you to New York on time. With your excess luggage. Allow me. My chauffeur's an excellent driver. You'll be at the airport in a few minutes. Goodbye, Mr. Zorro. Some other time, perhaps.
Happy landings, old boy.
I found him under the model.
Operation Grand Slam. I did enjoy your briefing. So did I.
Are you blind or something? You missed a turn.
Right, just ahead here somewhere.
This sequence, which was shot in Miami, proved to be one that was very difficult for optical effects technician Cliff Cully later on. A double was used for Harold Sakata as Oddjob, and the car, which is driven into the lot here, had the engine removed before it was taken and crushed in the car crusher. Cliff Cully remembers the problems this caused.
Well, that was a Ford, and it was supplied, and they did it in the States, but there was no engine in it. And when they picked it up on the grab and swung it round, you could see straight through it, because there was no engine in it, because it had been given to them by Ford to destroy. So we had to do a very tricky little optical where we had to blot out all the gaps. I mean, it didn't mean a thing on the screen, to be quite honest. It was just black lines, but it was tricky because it was moving the whole time.
For the small crew in Miami in January 1964, the crushing of the Lincoln seemed to represent a high point of waste and excess. The junkyard was in a poor neighborhood, and the contrast between the crushing of a brand new Lincoln Continental and the poverty surrounding the area was a little much for some of the crew members, although the end result is a great deal of fun on screen. Ken Adam remembers the crew's reaction and another problem that cropped up at the time.
I never forget that we were completely silent to see this beautiful new Lincoln, minus the engine, but being squashed and ending up as a cube. And while we were shooting it, Guy, I was standing next to Guy, and he kept saying to me, I said to him, I think the weight is going to be too much for that little pickup truck which we use. So he stopped the sequence and we cut, while the car still was like a sausage, we cut part of it so that the cube wasn't too heavy for that pickup truck. But if you watch the film carefully, you see the whole pickup truck going down like that as
the cube is loaded on it.
The crushed cube caused other problems for the film crew back in England. Production buyer Ron Quelch, who had worked on all the Bond films since Dr. No, had to find a matching mass of metal in the UK for the scene where Oddjob returns to Arkstud. Arkstud was a set at Pinewood Studios. This was a problem because no one could find a car-crushing device in England. Finally, the night before the prop was required, Ron Quelch found a scrapyard with the needed equipment. In this portion of the filmmakers are pulling out all the stops to cover for the lack of story material, and they do the job beautifully. Although director Guy Hamilton lets the scenes play, editor Peter Hunt keeps the pace alive with his cutting.
Giskish, two men in a car with binoculars. Touts looking for racing tips. There's another possibility, however. Kish asked Mr. Bond to join us. We were quite right to spare Mr. Bond's life in Switzerland if those gentlemen are his friends. Let's convince them he needs no assistance. For their benefit, Pussy, let's make him as happy as possible. I suggest you change to do something more suitable.
Certainly. Business before pleasure.
He wants you.
This scene between Bond and Goldfinger also tantalizes the audience. It came about because critics pointed out that it would be impossible to steal the gold from Fort Knox, just as James Bond also makes clear here in the movie. Aside from the exposition, screenwriters Maybaum and Den strengthen the scene by making Goldfinger's plan seem brilliantly conceived with every base covered. This took months of research and weeks of writing. Connery's respectful reaction lends even more credence to what we've just heard. If this plan impresses James Bond, then it must be good.
$1 billion in gold bullion weighs 10,500 tons. 60 men would take 12 days to load it onto 200 trucks. Now, at the most, you're going to have 2 hours before the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines move in and make you put it back.
Who mentioned anything about removing it? Did Julep Tottenham for you?
You plan to break into the world's largest bank, but not to steal anything. Why?
Go on, Mr. Bond.
Mr. Ling, the red Chinese agent at the factory. He's a specialist in nuclear fission. But of course, his government's given you a bomb.
I prefer to call it an atomic device. It's small, but particularly dirty.
Cobalt and iodine?
Precisely.
Well, if you explode it in Fort Knox, the entire gold supply of the United States will be radioactive for 57 years.
58, to be exact.
I apologize, Goldfinger. It's an inspired deal. They get what they want, economic chaos in the West, and the value of your gold increases many times.
I conservatively estimate 10 times.
Brilliant. But the atomic device, as you call it, is already obviously in this country.
Obviously.
But bringing it to Fort Knox undetected could be risky, very risky.
On the contrary, Mr. Bond, the risk is all on your side. If the authorities should attempt to locate it, who knows where it might be exploded, eh? Perhaps the Polaris submarine pens at New London. Cape Kennedy? Near the White House? But we are speculating idly. Operation Grand Slam will be successful.
You will be there to receive for yourself. Too closely for comfort, I'm afraid.
Oh, Forgive me, Mr. Bond, but I must arrange to separate my gold from the late Mr. Soro.
As you said, he had a pressing engagement.
Ah, very chic, Miss Galore. Don't you agree? Please entertain Mr. Bond for me, pussy. I'll join you both later.
Well, how about it, Hanson? Don't you think it's time we got to know each other socially?
Well, the new Miss Galore. Where do you hide your gold knuckles in this outfit?
Oh, I never carry weapons after business hours.
Yeah? So you're off duty?
I'm completely defenseless.
So am I.
That's my James.
Beautiful place Goldfinger has here.
Yes. I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Too bad it all has to end tomorrow morning. He's quite mad, you know. Well, now, what do we have here?
007 seems to have the situation well in hand. Come on, Ambush, let's get back to the motel.
You're quite a girl, Pussy.
I'm strictly the outdoor.
Coming up is a scene one rarely sees in films made after the late 70s, although it was very common before then, where the hero kisses a woman until she likes it. It is all playfully done here, but the idea behind it, that a woman just needs a man to forcefully break through the ice, lost credence as awareness of rape increased in society. The last straw for those scenes came in the appropriately named Straw Dogs, a film by Sam Peckinpah with Dustin Hoffman, where Hoffman's character's wife is raped and begins to enjoy it. Nevertheless, Honor Blackman has often professed to enjoying the filming of these scenes because of her experience rolling around in the hay with Sean Connery. Stuntman George Leach remembers helping out with the fights in this sequence.
It's just come back to me now, seeing Bond fighting Pussy Galore there. Yeah. And Bob and I had her by the arms and legs for one shot where she goes flying into the hay. I think Bond does a judo throw on her and throws her over his shoulder. And I wanted a shot of her landing. Bob and myself had her by the arms and legs, throwing her into the shot.
We are now entering a long portion of the film where James Bond has absolutely nothing to do. This was a risky move on the part of the Bond team, but it ends up increasing the suspense. Goldfinger's plan moves forward like clockwork. Aided by excellent music from John Barry, the film seems to be heading towards an inexorable conclusion that James Bond can do nothing to stop Goldfinger and his devious plan. John Barry recalls his approach.
I would take a day without even writing a note, just with a manuscript paper, say for a 2.5 minute action sequence, just looking at the film and saying, here, this has got to hit here, this has got to hit there, we go down here. Just absolutely mapping out a structural line before I got down to writing the music, what had to happen, and I'd make these funny little remarks about it. And then that would take a day, sometimes a day and a half, without music. And then once I had that like graph, if you like, of what was going to happen, then I'd sit and compose to that graph, knowing where the heights were, knowing where I had to hit. So it was a lot of work. And then they would drive you nuts, because you'd write a whole 2.5 minute sequence, say, with that kind of precision down to a third of a second, and then somebody from the cutting room would call and say, we've just taken 8 frames out, you know, or whatever, or 3.5 seconds we've just taken out. I would go nuts, because then the whole structure has to be changed. I remember the whole end sequence, the Fort Knox sequence in Goldfinger. I didn't receive that. We started recording on the Monday. I didn't receive that until Friday night. And it's a long sequence. You know, it's a long sequence. So you just bled. I mean, you bled. It's the nature of the beast.
champagne leader to Grand Slam Task Force leader. The baby is asleep.
I repeat, the baby is asleep. We're going home now. Out.
Ah!
All of this was built on the backlot at Pinewood Studios. Trees were even planted according to a map at Fort Knox that was used by the production crew. Cliff Cully remembers the particulars of shooting this sequence.
Sean was quite upset on that sequence as well, because he was handcuffed to Oddjob in the back of that Jeep, and it made quite a mess of his wrist. Really did. I mean, it cut into his wrist quite badly, and he was concerned about his golf. We shot the production shot, you know, knowing that it was going to be an optical or a map. They would always use our old Mitchell, which sounds like a terrible old coffee grinder. But it's rock steady. So we would go up on the set and shoot the scenes with our old Mitchell, which meant dubbing the sound on afterwards. And then we'd bring it back and superimpose the laser beam, which was a double exposure. It was always a pencil, you know, a hair, almost a hairline white. And then the same cells we used, animation cells, would be photographed again with a soft focus and a red filter on the camera. So you got this nice white piece right down the middle, and then a red glow around the outside. And all the shots of burning the door down were all done like that.
Filmmakers obviously went to great lengths to reproduce Fort Knox accurately. There is, of course, one small error that is made. The character Kish is wearing Air Force stripes on an Army uniform. Ken Adam, as usual, did a wonderful job on designing the atomic bomb which Goldfinger brings to Fort Knox. The bomb was much more difficult to construct than it was to design, and special effects man Bert Luxford had to stretch his imagination. In the shop, the long silver box quickly became known as Bert's coffin.
Actually, there's a funny story that goes with that. It's an atomic device, as I think you know. Supposed to believe, but I mean... When they asked us to build this thing, I said, well, what does an atomic device look like in a box? I said, well, really don't know. Make something that rotates inside so it looks good, and we're going to have countdown numbers with that sliding thing that's going in now of the countdown on. That was made by Frank George, actually, because I said it electronic-wise, he was vastly superior to myself or any other person in the shop. But I did the rest of it, and I know one of the directors, art directors, came in and said, well, it looks nice, but can't you make it look a bit more sexy? And I said to Frank at the time, well, how the hell would you make an atomic device look sexy? And then you see the engine turning on that, those rings, you'll see later on, when you get a close-up of the actual coffin, as we called it, we made it look a lot more engineering-looking by that engine turning all over it, inside and out, which took hours and hours and hours to do. You could do it with a cork and graphite on a drill. And when you're finished, you're, well, as black as a... as my camera is, and all down the front of everything. Oh, it took days to do that, but they loved it afterwards, you know.
And now for one of the most quoted lines from any Bond film.
Goodbye, Mr. Bond.
This is one of the great setups for a cinematic climax. James Bond handcuffed to an atomic bomb trapped in a giant gold vault with Oddjob. It's not in Ian Fleming's novel. All of this comes from the collective imaginations of the filmmakers involved with the sequence. A little note on Peter Hunt's editing. Here he picks up the pace and manages to do some things which he's very proud of, such as getting Goldfinger out of the control room for the vault door without ever seeing him pass through the door. It's these little snippets which make Peter Hunt's editing move so much more quickly. George Leach remembers the stunts on Ken Adams' remarkable set.
I remember in Fort Knox when Bob Simmons was thrown off the top by Oddjob. He almost hit the camera there. He dived so close, which made a much better shot. He almost hit the camera that was right down on the floor.
Ken Adam discusses the origins of the Gold Vault set.
We had an... friend of Cubby Broccoli was called Colonel Rouchon, who had great influence with the American authorities, including the White House. And so I was whisked off to Kentucky and was allowed to fly over Fort Knox and to look at it from the outside, but I wasn't allowed to go anywhere really near it because it was so protected, and there were sort of loudspeakers all over the place saying, you are now trespassing, don't approach any, and there were also people with machine guns in the place. So I never was allowed inside Fort Knox. But so I decided that I would reproduce the outside exactly and invent the inside, which I preferred in any case, because I'm sure it's like any other gold vault, you know, which is not that visual to an audience. and I decided to build gold up to 40 foot in height, and so that the audience was really in the biggest gold depository of the world. It was completely impractical, but as so often happens, UA, I think, received over 300 letters after the film was released. How were we allowed to film inside Fort Knox when even the President of the United States was not allowed inside the place? So they accepted it.
Joe Fitt and Bert Luxford discussed the special effects used in Killing Odd Job.
John and I did the execution of Odd Job. The hat that worked first time going through the bars of the vault. Mm. I mean, we had that on a stainless steel wire with a rubber bungee and a quick release. Of course, when Odd Job takes it off and then it's a two cut, he slings it. We tell us we're going to have a problem with this, but that hat went straight and wedged right in between the bars first time.
Yes,
we expected to bounce out in those three or four takes. But that was very good. As to say, with the fight with Sean and Oddjob, that when the hat hit the cable, when he got the hat again and hit the cable, then we had all the little bits of fireworks and stuff in there, and we had to keep that burning all the time in the spark without trying to burn anybody in that area, especially Oddjob.
Yeah, in fact, he did get one of the sparks on his hand, didn't he?
Yeah, and a couple of little sparks on his... Yeah. But he didn't complain at all. He was fantastic. We don't want to burn any artist or anything like that. He was fantastic about it.
Yeah, it was.
Stuntman George Leach.
Well, I'm surprised that he did that without really injuring himself, because there was no break for it. He just fell flat on his chest, because he had a very powerful chest.
Who was this?
Oddjob. When he's finally electrocuted, and he just does a front fall, dead flat, on his face and chest.
George Leach and optical effects supervisor Cliff Cully remember the final battle at Fort Knox.
That was a pretty big set. Frank George made all this. Frank George and Bert made that atomic bomb, you know, the big one that he wheeled in, yeah, with all the mechanism inside it.
A very realistic set. Yeah. They said it was just a figment of the imagination of Ken Adam.
Mm.
His idea of what it would be like. They would never let him see inside the place. There's quite a big contingent of stuntmen we had in there, blowing each other up and shooting all around the balconies.
This was on A stage, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Over here, yeah. On the tallest sets I think I've seen. It went all the way up to the... almost right up to the gantries, you know.
Yeah.
It was a very high set.
That's Alf Joint. Come over the balcony, did a twisting one and a half. Somebody else, I don't think that was me, I'm not sure about that. I think I came off as he was doing it, as the countdown was working. But you never know in sequence, because, you know, the editor can cut backwards and forwards and use the same thing twice in different parts of the film.
We have now reached the end of the main story. James Bond, by seducing Pussy Galore, has saved the gold supply of the United States. There is, of course, one twist left. While we wait for Goldfinger to play his last trump, there are a few final notes. First, Goldfinger is considered a textbook example of how to create an engaging adventure film. But it is a film which has rarely been successfully copied. The reason is simple. The makers of Goldfinger were willing to break all of the rules. First, Bond defeats the villain repeatedly during the film's first half. Second, James Bond has little to do with the second half of the film. Even in the final moments, James Bond, having killed Oddjob, is left to do battle with a machine. This isn't the way these films are supposed to work. In a conventional film, Pussy Galore's conversion would happen on screen. Bond would team with her, and they would together try to unravel Goldfinger's plot. But it is just because of such unconventional structures that Goldfinger works so well and continues to entertain audiences 30 years after its initial release.
I am glad to have you aboard, Mr. Bond.
Joe Fitt and Burt Luxford discuss what was required to kill off Art Goldfinger.
Are you having lunch at the White House, too?
In 2 hours. In actual fact, there's quite a few of us worked on that effect. Obviously, the person that went out was a dummy. No, it wasn't a real man. And he's actually snatched out, wasn't it, this dummy?
We actually got him halfway through. First of all, what happened when the gun was fired, the glass went in the cabin. Yeah. Then we did an insert on that, and we did that with a sawn-off shotgun, so that everything just went out in one go, as it naturally would do, so we thought. And we got Gert on the board, started pulling through when he's doing all his actions. Then on the last part, then we had the riggers put a cable rope round the dummy, and then they pulled it through, so everything,
yeah.
It's all,
yeah, they just cut it together, didn't they?
And cut it together, yeah.
But was not a very easy thing to do.
This concludes the audio commentary for Analog Channel 2 on Goldfinger. I'm John Cork of the Ian Fleming Foundation. I'd like to thank all the artists who participated in this audio commentary channel, and particularly pay tribute to Paul Scrabo, who edited together these commentaries for your enjoyment. Thank you.
Time to be rescued.
A cold finger.